Now back to KNBR's Giants pregame. You're talking baseball with Marty Lurie on The Sports Leader.
As I said, the Indians lineup pretty good today. They're 12-3-2. Who knew? Who saw that coming? Michael Bourne in center. Nick Swisher, always a favorite of the DH. Jason Kipnis at second. Nice ball player, hitting .346 this spring. Their batting averages don't mean a lot, but Michael Brantley is in left field. I think he just got a big contract, .458. David Murphy, remember him from Texas? He is in right. Lonnie Chisenhall, you hear his name all the time. He is at third. Brian LaHare, I think he was Cubs and Colorado, if I'm not mistaken. He's at first. Justin Sellers is at short, hitting a cool .500. And Matt Traynor, seen him before. I think Marlins, Tigers, if I'm not mistaken. He is doing the catching today, and Aaron Harang is on the hill. Let's take a couple of calls. John Rosengren stayed around here. All right, let's go to Billy in San Rafael. Billy, you're on KNBR 680.
Hey, Marty. Wow, what a treat to have Mr. Rosengren. Is that how you say it?
No, it's pronounced John.
Oh, yeah, what a treat to have John.
I got a funny guy here. Now I have to be a straight man again. Willie Mays isn't enough for me. All right, John. Here we go.
Yeah, get it together, Marty. You're on the radio. Forget it.
Really? I'm turning it to the straight man for everybody here. All right, go ahead.
It's really great to hear him. And I was a little girl of 11, and I remember it so vividly. My dad in the backyard, and then we talked about it a lot afterwards. So just really, really great to know that book is out there, and it's exciting to, as we say, we always learn something with you, and this is great.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Billy, what did your dad tell you about it? How did your dad help you understand what you had heard or seen happen?
Well, he was really empathetic, you know, to all the race issues, and had a way of saying there's always more than one side of the story. So, you know, you never saw much on TV then. I mean, it was more like the Life magazine stuff. And he had more of a take on it, like, as you were saying, back in his home country and then the things going on in Watts and, you know, the incredible rivalry with the Dodgers. And, you know, just sort of that idea that there's always more than one side. And, yes, that ball coming by his head, too. You know, like, as you were saying, you're not expecting that from the catcher. So, you know, as I say, my dad didn't talk much. That's going to be the name of my book. Wish he was here to talk about it now. He left us early, but, yeah, I do remember that as a kid. And, you know, little girls weren't as necessarily paying as much attention to baseball, but that's why I really appreciate that my dad and I would have it on the radio in the backyard.
Well, it sounds like
you did talk about it a lot.
Sounds like your dad was a wise man. You're blessed to have him with you.
Yeah, thank you.
Billy, thank you so much. Thanks, Billy. All right, let's go to John in San Francisco, 808 KNBR. Go ahead, John. You're on KNBR 680. Go ahead, John.
Oh, hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call here.
Sure, glad to.
I was 10 years old when it happened, and my father's take on it, I'd like to ask the author if I could. He thought the real villain of this whole affair was Don Drysdale. He thought he really created an incredibly tense atmosphere that he was constantly headhunting, and he thought that might have contributed to this. I'd like to get his take on that.
Well, certainly Drysdale didn't do a whole lot to soothe tensions between the two teams, did he? I mean, he was constantly hitting batters, but I don't think he reserved that for Giants. I think he was indiscriminate in guys he hit. Anybody who leaned over the plate or needed a message, Drysdale would throw hard and inside at him. Now, I think, and there had been tension before that, earlier in the season between the two teams, and Drysdale had plunked some Giants. But I think that the immediate tensions were during that series. Maury Wills had reached back, faked the bunt and then reached back and hit Holler's mitt, and that got called for interference. And then when Matty Alou tried to do that to Roseboro, he missed Roseboro's glove, but the ball came in and hit Roseboro. Couldn't catch the ball. He was distracted. And the ball hit him in the chest. And that was one of the events that really ticked off Roseboro. So I don't think we can really blame Drysdale fairly in this. I think it was more the tension, the general tension between the two teams, and then those specific incidents of the catcher's interference and the join that occurred as a result of that.
And then one other thing, Marty, you mentioned Orlando Cepeda, and he had quite an encounter that day with Wally Moon. I wonder if that's covered in the book.
You know, I don't go into that. Certainly Cepeda plays into the story, being one of the Spanish-speaking players on the team and a friend of Marshall's. But, you know, I tried to keep the focus on Roseboro and Marshall and their lives and how they intersected and then the aftermath of that and how they eventually reconciled.
Hey, John, thank you so much, huh? All right, John is gone. John Rosengren, thank you so much, John, the caller. Let's go to Bruce Jenkins. Of course, it's time to look through the window of baseball, and we do that for Marvin Windows and Truitt and White, the professional builder's choice. Marvin Windows now down on the peninsula in the Monterey area. Bruce, good morning.
Hey, Marty, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I wanted John to stick around a little bit. You've heard some of the discussion. The book is The Fight of Their Lives, and John has a different perspective on it, giving a lot of the background that historically was going on. And how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm delighted that a book's been written about it. I haven't seen it, but, I'm just catching the last couple minutes of this. But, you know, it's the kind of incident that really requires exploration in retrospect because it was so crazy. It just came from completely out of nowhere. I can barely remember anything comparable to it except maybe Campy Campaneris flinging his bat at Laron Legros during the 72 American League playoffs. But, you know, as a Dodger fan at that time living in Southern California, I just remember Koufax coming down off the mound and, oh my, and just get him out of there. Don't let anybody hit Koufax, you know, keep him away from this. And I thought the sight of Willie Mays restraining Roseboro very sympathetically, with Roseboro trying to get to Marichal, Shag Crawford was a plate umpire. He got right in the middle of it, which took an awful lot of guts. There's so much going on, and it's, that game was one of the few times when Koufax threw message pitches. I mean, he was famous for never really hitting a guy or even really brushing him back. I mean, a high and tight fastball from him was plenty enough message, but he never got as nasty as Drysdale. And he threw a couple of message pitches in that game just because things were so incredibly heated between the teams.
He also, earlier in the season, had plunked Lou Brock right in the ribs when Brock had shown him up. And so Koufax wasn't opposed to throwing at guys when the situation called for it.
Yeah.
He just didn't want to throw at their heads because he knew he could hurt them, and he was a good guy and didn't want to do that.
Yeah, which is the message for all pitchers. I mean, go ahead and nail a guy in the ribs, but anytime you go for the head, you're completely out of line no matter how heated things are.
Yeah, it's funny. Was it yesterday? I forget what it was. I think I was talking to Gaylord Perry, and he talked about someone who he had to hit, and he had to hit him in the back. He said, look, I couldn't hit him high. I had to just drill him in the back. I forget the context of it, but pitchers did that in those days.
Maybe the ball slipped out of Perry's hand.
Possibly.
With all that gunk on it.
Possibly.
No, you're right, though. That was the code at the time. You threw at the batter, and you sent a message. You stood up for your players.
Bruce, John Rosengren is our author who's with us. The book is The Fight of Their Lives, and I'd love to give you a copy of it to take a look at it when I see you.
Absolutely.
But his perspective is the Watts riots were going on. Roseboro was very much affected by that. There was civil war in the Dominican Republic. Marichal, sort of a pacifist, was very disturbed at that. And then all of a sudden, the confluence of the batting situation and the pennant race came together, and that was sort of the catalyst. These guys had a short fuse, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I that makes perfect sense to me. It wasn't really related in those terms at the time. But in retrospect, I think, you know, what was going on in the larger world, you know, really affected these guys. And the tempers were a little bit on edge always between the Giants and the Dodgers, but especially in those days. And that's entirely plausible to me.
Oh, great. John, we're going to let John Rosengren go. John, thank you so much for being here, and the book is terrific.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, Marty. I really appreciate your interest.
All right, it's The Fight of Their Lives. Now we're back to Bruce Jenkins. And talking a little baseball with Bruce, something came up today I was thinking about in replay. And I know it's coming, and this week we're going to see a lot of it because the Giants have so many night games. Did you see what Joe Maddon said, Bruce, earlier about replay? That when a play happens, don't stop.
Yeah.
In other words, play this thing out as carefully and as long as you can because who knows where they're going to put the runners. I like that.
Yeah, let's just say there's a guy in first, you're up there, and you hit a hooking liner down the line, and it's going to be close, and it hits just outside the chalk, and the umpire waves foul, but you got to keep running. You don't stop now. You keep running, and if you're in the outfield, you play it as if it was called fair, because you never know if the play is challenged and all of a sudden it turns out the ball was fair, then you've done yourself a huge favor by running it out and also making it throw.
Now, on the other side of the coin, what does the defense do? And, you know, you're in the outfield. They've called it foul. And normally you're going to sort of slow down, right?
Well, that's what I just said. I mean, you have to the outfielder has to come up throwing. He's got to assume it's fair.
Yeah.
Just come up throwing, and we'll see what happens later. You can't hurt, but it might prove to be. I mean, if the guy is running and then he throws the guy out. Meanwhile, the play's called foul, but meanwhile the runner's charging into second and he's thrown out. If the play is challenged, maybe it isn't challenged after that, but you have to assume that it'll be challenged and it could be reversed, and the way you react to the play at the time really matters.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I got lost in that whole translation there. But, no, I'm telling you, I've never heard the Giants talk about this. Bochy has not said anything about this, and I imagine every team will be instructed to do that.
Well, I think you have to. And, you know, there's going to be the issue of where to place the runners if a foul ball is called fair. And if the runners are all going all out, it might be a little easier. There's going to be a lot of things that come up. I'm sure there's things that nobody's really thought of, and it's going to be, oh, my God, look what's happening here. You know, I mean,
well,
I was just going to say, I'm kind of bothered by the fact that the team would leave the field after a play that is apparently the third out. And then all of a sudden they have to come back onto the field because it actually wasn't the third out. That's kind of strange, you know.
No, I'm telling you, there's going to be some strange moments of sitting there. The pitcher's going to – I saw this in the fall league. The pitcher stands there on the mound. The runner disappears in the dugout. The catcher's looking up in the sky. The umpires are huddled together. And you're sitting there saying, what just happened?
Yeah. Well, there's going to be some pitchers just stewing out there. You know, maybe they'll throw a couple of warm-up pitches, but, you know, it's all about rhythm for pitchers.
Yeah,
if you've got a two-minute delay and this and that, and, I mean, it could really throw somebody's rhythm off.
Yeah, do this to Bob Gibson, see what happens.
No, he'll throw at the replay official 3,000 miles away.
You know, and they have to get replay in the ballpark, I think.
That's another issue.
Yeah, ultimately. They're great.
Because they say that the fans will be part of this. They're going to be able to see the play in question, and it's probably going to open the door to pretty much everything subject to replay, whether there's a replay for the fans' benefit on the scoreboard, whether there's a challenge or not, which I think is good.
Yeah, this is going to be an interesting week because the Giants have all these night games, and they're going to be doing the replay stuff this week, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
It's going to be good. Hey, another thing I saw in the news this morning, of course, Bruce Jenkins is with us. Brian Price, the manager of the Reds, I don't know if you saw this one. He has said he is not going to be the traditional manager of matchups.
I love that piece.
Yeah, wasn't it good?
Yeah, you know why? I mean, let's say you bring in a left-hander to face a lefty, and there's a right-hand hitter on deck. Now, the lefty just throws one of the best curves he's ever thrown in his life, along with a 96-mile-an-hour fastball, and struck the guy out. He obviously has his stuff and a half. He's absolutely loaded and ready to go. Now you take him out just because there's a right-hander up? I think that's part of Price's thinking, and I really like that. I've always been steamed when a guy who's absolutely lighting up the building is taken out for percentages. When the next guy, I mean, he may not have his fastball or his curve tonight. I mean, you know this guy has it. So now you're going to yank him just for the percentages? I think a lot of times that's wrong, and that seems to be part of what Price is saying.
And, you know, I'll tell you another thing. Pitchers generally don't become managers.
No,
they
I know.
They become
it's
pitching
rare.
Coaches. So
yeah,
he now, he's now got the floor. Really?
Yeah, Shades of Lasorda and Bud Black and Roger Craig. There aren't many of them. There haven't been many.
No, John Farrell.
The game. Yeah, John Farrell, sure, yeah.
Yeah, but as Barry Bloom just said, Bud Black sitting behind me. But he now has the floor. This is going to be fascinating to me to see how he does. Now, of course, he's got Chapman.
Yeah.
And, you know, who cares who's hitting with him? But that's the closer. You're not going to mess around with him.
Yeah, teams usually don't mess around with the closers. Once he comes in, the ninth inning is his, no matter who's up there. We're talking more about seventh and eighth inning situations when you know, sometimes that procession of relievers dictated entirely by the percentages. You have to give that a second thought. That's what Price is doing, and you know, it might save an arm or two here and there.
You know, again, Bruce, one last thought for you. You know, it's spring training. There'll be 12,000 out here today. We always said, and you've written about, the fans bond back with baseball. It's spring training for us. We get to hear the ball hit the glove. We get to see the outfielders throw. It's our way of just reorienting ourselves to baseball. And I'm in the clubhouse today, and I said to myself, you know something? These guys live together as a family for 7 months. This first month of getting to know each other again, getting to know new ball players, is very, very important when the season starts. I think there's a value, not just in getting in shape, but there's an intrinsic value of getting to know your teammates.
Yeah, and I think we really benefit in the Bay Area. We'll benefit all season from the fact that both the Giants and the A's have very cohesive clubhouses. You know, the guys they brought in, guys like Punto and Hudson and Morse, and you know, these guys are not just good ball players with a great work ethic, but they blend in, you know, with the guys. They've got a sense of humor. They know how to keep things light. And it doesn't automatically win you anything, but it sure can't hurt. You know, it's certainly a lot better than say, I don't know, who knows with Ryan Braun, for example. I mean, there might be some guys on that team that are kind of simmering, you know, a little bit about this whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think the Giants and A's are in good shape that way.
Yeah, let's say you bring Hudson in June. Well, there's a transition period. You know, get to know him. How does he pitch? What does he do? Catching, all that. So the month for baseball players is bigger than I thought. I just hit me this morning that it's actually a very important month to get to know your teammates and get to know who you are a year later and the new people. And I think it's important for a ball club.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, because you know, by the time the season starts, a lot of the bonding has already taken place.
Right.
And you hit the ground running.
Yeah, I think it is. Hey, what are you doing today? What's up with you?
I'm going to watch a little tennis, Federer and Djokovic, and I'm getting a new cable system, Comcast, where I can tape four things at once, and by God, that's right up my alley.
Yes, it is. You know, it's funny, the tennis tournament's in Indian Wells today, and Howard Bryant was here last week,
right.
And, you know, I'm not really a big tennis fan. I mean, I know some of it, but I'm having lunch with him. I said, Howard, where are you going? He says, to Indian Wells. I thought he was going to play. And he was so offended. I mean, he was just appalled that I didn't know this is the fifth biggest tournament in the world.
It really is. It's a little paradise down there. It's Larry Ellison, who thinks and builds big. He's built a. He's even trying to get the U.S. Open there maybe every 4 or 5 years.
That's exactly what Howard said.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, enjoy it today. Now I know it's a big tournament.
Pretty big.
All right. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, Marty. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.